welcome to the Week Ahead in Russia, RFNL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and my guest is Irina Lagunina, Associate Standards Editor and former Director and Special Projects Editor of the Russian Service at RFERL. Welcome, Irina, and thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting, Steve.
Okay, well, it's great to have you on the podcast again. Now, Russia's war against Ukraine is continuing with no end in sight. There's heavy fighting, as there has been, in the Donbass region of eastern Ukraine, particularly around Bakhmut and other cities and towns, including Avdiivka. And there are more deaths of civilians in Russian attacks. In the context of Russia assuming the rotating presidency of the United Nations Security Council over the weekend for this month, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said that a five-year-old boy was among the civilians killed in Avdiivka, and Ukrainian authorities said yesterday, I believe, that more than 20 civilians had been killed in recent Russian attacks over just the previous day or so before that. But we're going to talk about developments in Russia itself. I mean, these are all related to the war, like pretty much everything in Russia now. The first thing I want to ask you about, Irina, is a really unprecedented and I would say objectively disturbing development, the arrest of Evan Gershkovich, a Wall Street Journal reporter who was detained by the Federal Security Service on March 29th while reporting in Yekaterinburg and is now being held at the notorious Lefortovo jail in Moscow. The Wall Street Journal vehemently denies the Russian claim that he was spying, and many, many colleagues have vouched for his integrity as a journalist. The White House has called the espionage accusation ridiculous, and U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken condemned it as part of, quote, the Kremlin's continued attempts to intimidate, repress, and punish journalists and civil society voices. Now, Gershkovich is the first and only American journalist to be arrested on an espionage accusation in Russia since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, which happens to be, I believe, the year he was born. So this really is unprecedented in part because until now, foreign journalists accredited with the Russian Foreign Ministry were, or at least seemed to be, protected from a politically motivated or geopolitically motivated persecution at the hands of the Russian authorities. As Joshua Yaffa, a friend and colleague of Gershkovich's, wrote in a New Yorker article about Evan following the arrest, amid a growing state campaign, these are my words, amid a growing state campaign targeting independent journalists and media outlets in Russia in recent years, Yaffa wrote, quote, foreign correspondents continued to occupy a position of relative privilege and safety, unquote. The most recent and maybe the only comparable arrest came in 1986 when American reporter Nicholas Danilov was detained and accused of espionage. He was released a few weeks later and exchanged, I don't think he was formally charged, and he was exchanged in a swap for an employee of the Soviet mission to the United Nations who'd been arrested by the FBI, also on spy charges. Irina, there's been speculation that Russia arrested Gershkovich in order to essentially hold him hostage for a potential swap like that one. And a lot of people are calling him, a hostage of Russia, or a swap like the one far more recently in December, in which American basketball star Brittany Griner was exchanged for Russian arms dealer Viktor Bout. You and I discussed that on this podcast at the time. Some also see Gershkovich's arrest as this is not necessarily a different reason, but an overlapping reason, perhaps. But some see it as a signal to Western journalists and media outlets and Western countries in general, essentially saying, do not try to discover the truth about the war in Ukraine or anything else. What are your thoughts on this, Irina, and your knowledge from the Russian service reporting? Basically, what seems to be behind the arrest of Evan Gershkovich?
Well, Steve, I think that those two points that you mentioned, to send a signal to Western media and to keep Evan as a hostage for a future exchange, those are both probably prime reasons why the Russian authorities did it. They would definitely keep him to swap with somebody. That's for sure. They will make profit out of it, and they also sent signal to the Western media, and by the way, to Russian media as well. And there is even third point in all this, that there is a signal that I'm exaggerating right now, right? That our law enforcement is not sleeping. We are doing our job. We are arresting spies, and this propaganda message that Russia is under threat, that Russia the West wants to crush Russia. The West wants to get Russia's secrets. There are spies everywhere. This is also a very significant message to the Russian society in terms of propaganda. By the way, when the society is so closely controlled by the law enforcement or by the power agencies, better to say, because the legal side of this control is questionable, when the society is under such a tough control of the state, then this state power ministries need to sometimes, from time to time, need to prove that they're active and that they fulfill their duties, whatever they understand under this duties is. So I think that this is a very disturbing development, and you probably also read that once again the State Department is calling on all Americans to leave the country because it's not safe to be there, to work there, as we see. So that's a very sad development in Russia. It is a coincidence probably, but the next day after this arrest, Russia published its new strategic defense doctrine, where it is actually making an aim to be a self-isolated state. So the public is being prepared for this total isolation from the rest of the world. Steve?
Thanks, Irina. Those are some great additional points that I hadn't thought of. In some cases, they're both kind of the signal to Russians that, hey, we're doing our job, from the security services, as you say, probably not really the best description to call them law enforcement agencies, but to say, look, we're doing our job. And I think they're trying to show both the Kremlin and the people that. And that's all in the context of this kind of the way that Putin and the Kremlin are using, are casting and portraying the war in Ukraine, portraying it not as a war of aggression on their part, on Russia's part, but as essentially a defensive war against the West and NATO, not just Ukraine, or not primarily Ukraine, but claiming, again, this is, I would also say ridiculous, but that the West, the United States, NATO are trying to, are out to essentially undermine and destroy Russia, and using Ukraine to do that. So this arrest, I would say, fits in it fits into that false narrative.
But Steve, if I may interrupt you, I was thinking, I have another parallel in mind when it comes to this arrest. Strangely enough, I was thinking about the killing of Paul Khlebnikov, the editor of the Russian edition of Forbes magazine in 2004. And why I was thinking about this parallel is because at that time, it was the start of the crack on investigative journalism in Russia. And Paul was exactly the person who was conducting very interesting investigations. And his killing was like a signal to Russian investigative journalists that that's be your fate. Don't try to mess with the states, with the state. So, it is a very powerful signal that the Russian authorities are given by, harassing or even killing Western media.
Absolutely. That's a great analogy, I think in part because, it's obviously sort of a different context in many ways. But it is also, as you said, seems to have been a signal of, don't pry, don't do your work as a journalist. And that's, what, the signal that was sent in a very, murderous way, obviously with Paul Khlebnikov, who is, was American and, with roots in Russia. But yeah, that's a very interesting analogy. And also, you mentioned the idea of the new foreign policy doctrine and isolation, the idea that, the moving further in an almost North Korean way to isolation. And there was another development also yesterday that sort of played into that, which was a suspension order. A court ordered the Anglo-American School of Moscow to suspend operations for 90 days, meaning the rest of the school year and more. And this is a school where most of the children, I would say, of U.S., British, and Canadian diplomats go, who are in Moscow. So that's another signal. And I think the U.S. said, well, you're creating conditions that make it impossible to, to do diplomacy. So I think that fits in as well. But obviously, the arrest of Gershkovich, a disturbing signal. And I believe, I'm not sure as of today, but as of yesterday, I don't think the Wall Street Journal had been able to be in contact with him. And he is in this kind of jail, with Fort of a prison, a jail that was used by the KGB and now the FSB to hold prisoners. So we will see how that develops. And obviously, a disturbing development. So thanks very much. I'll keep my second question shorter. It's about signs of increasing pressure on Russian artists, performers, and cultural figures who've spoken out against the invasion of Ukraine, the war in Ukraine. Two examples this past week involving artists in very different musical genres. In Moscow, police used a claim of a bomb threat to disrupt a concert by classical pianist Polina Osetinskaya. The venue was evacuated, but the concert resumed after no bomb was found. I think this came after the police had initially tried to stop the concert from even taking place. So the background is Osetinskaya on February 24th, 2022, the day Russia launched the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. She wrote on Instagram that she felt horror, shame, and disgust over the invasion and called it a dark day in Russian history. Meanwhile, the same day that this concert took place, last week in Siberia, a rock group called Spleen was taken off the schedule for a summer festival in Novosibirsk. Now, last year, Spleen had angered the authorities by dedicating a song to Machina Времени and Aquarium, two very famous groups that are reportedly on a list of artists informally banned for opposing the war or refusing to publicly support the war. So, Irina, what's going on with this clampdown on performers?
Well, you know, Steve, we often speak about like censorship in terms of media. And this is not really true in Russia anymore, because censorship actually goes in all segments of the society. It's not only media, it's not television. People, you know, we sometimes say that, oh, Russians support the war because they watch television. But it's not only this. It's also books. It's also theaters. It's, you know, pop and rock performance. It's this whole machine of propaganda that is actually now aggressively squeezing out those people who do not support the war. And it's... we don't know the statistics, but it's definitely hundreds of cultural, figures, actresses, writers, poets, that directors that had to leave Russia over the last year or so because of the but since the start of the war, what is going on in Russia? I mean, it's difficult to imagine living in this society right now because, for example, the local authorities in several cities, and to me, it's still unclear whether it was like an order from the center or it's somebody started to do and then the rest decided to follow the example. But for example, the books that were the bestsellers of the most prominent contemporary Russian writers like Boris Akunin, like Dmitry Быков, like Dmitry Golkovsky, like Lyudmila Ulitskaya, they are all now named foreign agents. And what they do in bookstores, they wrap those books with paper manually, and they write foreign agent on the paper to cover those books. This is unbelievable, but it is the reality in Russia. There are libraries that claim that they got the order on local level or from local authorities that certain books should be taken off the shelves. But I think that the most horrible example happened last week, actually, in Ulan-Ude. This is the capital of Buryatia, and you probably heard this name quite a lot of times recently because there are so many, people that were contracts that went to fight in Ukraine, and then there's so many mobilized in this Russian Republic that also were sent to the war in Ukraine. But in Ulan-Ude, a drama actor, Artur Shuvalov, actually cut his veins on his arms at the end of the performance in the protest against the pressure that he lived in for the last year. At the beginning of the war, the former artistic director of the theater, Sergei Levitsky, had a very, very strong anti-war position. He, together with the actors, actually took off the letter Z that somebody put on the theater, and he was fired and replaced with a more convenient for authorities personage. But then this whole year, there was the pressure on the actors who supported the former theater director. Shuvalov, when he made this attempt of suicide on the scene of the theater, he said that he couldn't tolerate the pressure anymore. He doesn't have any force left to withstand this pressure. It just shows to what extent the Russian cultural elite is under pressure to support this war, and those who do not do it is just being squeezed out of the society, no matter how popular they are. By the way, one of the actresses that was fired from this theater, and she was in the theater since she worked in the theater since 1977, Lia Hidjakova, was also forced. She decided to travel abroad and give concerts outside Russia because there is no place to work for her in Russia. The same with poet Veronika Dolina, who recently left Russia and started her tour with probably concert meetings or poetical meetings within Russia, with Russian diaspora abroad. So this is just the whole new dimension of the war that we don't necessarily see, but that exists as well. And this is a huge tragedy for the Russian society, because once again, we are speaking about the most sometimes the most popular, the most authoritative, cultural figures in Russia that's being squeezed out, and whose cultural heritage the Russian authorities are now trying to eliminate, Steve.
Right, absolutely. And you, and of course, the Russian government says that Russia is being canceled, or its culture is being canceled abroad. You know, in fact, many would say that the Russian government is canceling Russian culture at home. And you've given two kind of very good examples, I think, of this problem. Obviously very disturbing ones. One, Lia Akhijakova, in Moscow, she's extremely well known, well respected, very conscientious, a person who's been kind of at the center of Russian, acting, theater, films for decades, and her leaving, and then this situation at a lesser known theater in Buryatia, with the whole background of that in terms of young men from Buryatia being sent or going to the war in greater numbers, and other regions where there are ethnic minorities in greater numbers than in Russia as a whole. So that's also ties into that, I guess, but really kind of a bleak picture. Now, the third thing I want to discuss, usually we only talk about two issues on this podcast, but I just want to mention the other development, another development that occurred inside Russia in recent days. Sometimes rabid pro-war blogger, who went by the name Vladlen Tatarsky, was killed in a bomb blast at a St. Petersburg cafe yesterday, seemingly assassinated. Though there are also claims that the Wagner mercenary group founder Yevgeny Prigozhin may have been expected at the same nationalist event at the cafe that was interrupted when this bomb went off and Tatarsky was killed and some, I believe, 15 or more people injured. Vladlen is an abbreviation of Vladimir Lenin, for those who might not have known, and the name was fairly common in the Soviet era, but that's kind of an aside. But Tatarsky's real name was Maxim Fomin, and the term blogger perhaps doesn't do him justice. There's a clip of him from September, I believe, after a speech by Putin with Fomin or Tatarsky saying, "We will kill everyone, rob everyone we need to, the way we like it." He's talking about Ukraine there. Anyway, Russian officials are blaming Ukraine for his death, his killing, and also now claiming that Alexei Navalny's or supporters of Alexei Navalny's anti-corruption commission were involved. And these are just, you know, they provided no evidence of this. But meanwhile, Ukrainian officials are saying it was more likely an internal dispute among Russian radicals. And in fact, Prigozhin said he didn't believe Ukrainians were behind it, though his words may not reflect his actual thoughts or knowledge. Anyway, a suspect has been detained, a woman who's accused of bringing the bomb into the cafe. But my guess is that what we may see, while we may see a kind of a bigger, somehow bigger crackdown or clampdown on any forms of dissent, anti-war sentiment as a result of this, you know, we may not soon find out who was actually behind it. Irina?
Absolutely no. We will not. I suspect that, you know, there's the Russian authorities now gave the name of the suspect officially. They even distributed the video of her statement. So they really try to influence the public opinion, apparently, right now. So this is a 26 years old Daria Trepova. Yes, she is like an anti-war activist. She was detained at the demonstration last year on the 24th of February when the war, the aggression, the full-scale aggression started. But nothing in her bio actually points out to the fact that she can be in a terrorist group or, you know, reserved to terror to protest the war. So even her husband, who is abroad, by the way, stated, and he is the a member of the Libertarian Party, stated that he doubts that she can be, you know, an effective, you know, organizer of this crime, or even knew that she was bringing in this statuette with explosive inside, as the authorities claim that it's this statue that she brought in exploded in the cafe. I think that we will never find out what's behind it, and it will be like an information explosion at the beginning, and then it will die out. Because if you remember, August last year, the daughter of the Kremlin ideologist, Daria Dugina, was killed in the car explosion. And immediately the Russian authorities claimed that this was made by a Ukrainian lady who traveled with in Russia with even with her daughter and then escaped Russia. And it died. It kind of, there is no information, there is no continuation of this story. It was in all headlines. And that's what people remember, that, you know, those are Ukrainian authorities who organized a terrorist attack in, within the Russian state. I think here it will be the same, but the truth will never come out.
Yeah, so I guess, I mean, that's a good point. I guess for propaganda purposes, you know, they just need to, the Russian state just needs to keep it in the news for, you know, a news cycle or two, and then and then it's over, and that kind of image of, oh, it was, you know, Ukraine with the help of Navalny, which is essentially what the anti-terrorist committee is saying, will be what's remembered, at least in Russia. And you pointed out that the suspect who's been detained, the police released, as they sometimes do, a video showing part of what they call a confession. Now, these things need to be treated with extreme caution and kind of doubt, because, you know, obviously they can be recorded under duress. So, you know, nothing that's said is really, you know, it just can't be relied on. But that's another thing. You know, these things are shown. This is one of the tactics of the Russian security structures, is that they release these videos of suspects, which pretty much cast them as not suspects, but as, you know, as guilty. Before they're even arrested or tried or formally charged. So we'll see how that develops as well. And you mentioned, of course, the killing of Daria Dugina. And I hadn't really thought about that, but it's true. It was kind of, you know, it was huge splash, you know, obviously a very big story. But then in terms of the Russian investigation and what happened, and there were lots of holes, as I recall, in the authorities' account of this supposed suspect, and how she and her daughter had gotten through Russia and out of Russia. But that was pretty much forgotten, at least I think in the eyes of the Russian state media. Okay, we are getting short on time, but we can take a few questions if there are any. Now, I do see at least one question has come in. Bear with me for a second. From a paratyper. The question is, why are journalists across the world using the word propaganda in describing not Russian state resources, I guess news resources, but bloggers specifically? So I'll turn to Irina in a minute, but I think that question, unless I'm misunderstanding it, might relate to why people like bloggers like Vladlen Tartarsky are sometimes called propagandists, or what they put out is sometimes called propaganda as opposed to a blog or journalism. And that's something that's come up with Tartarsky. And to me, the reason is a lot of what he and others, these kind of pro-war bloggers are posting or writing, publishing, you know, it does look more like propaganda than news or than opinion. So that would be my answer. But again, it's possible that I misunderstood the question. Irina?
Well, I would say I understood it the same way. But I also would add that, the reason why, for example, Russian authorities didn't close down YouTube and didn't close down Telegram, but closed down Twitter and Facebook is because they are using YouTube and Telegram to spread their message. And there are quite a lot of channels in Telegram and quite a lot of what they call war bloggers that absolutely, consciously spread the government, the authorities' position. Some of them are being fed with information by the Ministry of Defense. So they are not, let's say, independent. They are pretty much work on the state. So they would be in the category of propagandists as well as the state-controlled media. And it doesn't, one doesn't necessarily need to be a part of state-owned media to be a propagandist. It's a matter where you get the money rather than where you work.
Right. Thanks very much for that, Irina. And kind of underscores the idea that, you know, there's state especially during the war, since the large scale invasion in February 2022, you know, there's the state media, there's non-state media that are pretty much loyal to the state, and then there are bloggers, there are people on the internet. So it's kind of a full court press of this disinformation in some cases. And there's subtleties in terms of loyalties. I mean, I guess, you know, Prigozhin obviously has very tense relations with the defense ministry, and in the military, and some some bloggers have kind of allied with him, and so they're used, you know, not only for kind of the propaganda that's one would say outward facing, but also internally, there are kind of gradations and maybe kind of infighting that these various kind of media are used for. Okay, let's see if we have any more questions. We can take another, I think. I don't see any now. We'll give it a few moments. Okay, if not, right, okay. Well, let's wrap it up here. Irina, great to talk to you again. Thanks very much for joining me and for your insights.
My pleasure, and thanks for inviting Steve.
Okay, once again, I've been speaking to Irina Lagunina, Associate Standards Editor and former Director and Special Projects Editor of the Russian Service at RFERL. And my name is Steve Gutterman, Editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. As I mentioned, this conversation will also be published as a podcast, and you can subscribe to The Week Ahead in Russia and other RFERL podcasts on Apple, Spotify, Google, and other podcast platforms. No podcast next week, but I'll be back on April 17th for the next installment of The Week Ahead in Russia. And please keep an eye out for the next edition of my newsletter, The Week in Russia, on Friday, April 14th. Thanks for listening.